77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Good morning and welcome to Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
Yeah, Deacon is away. He's at a wedding of friends and extending the weekend so he can enjoy with his family. And we wish him some peaceful time away from me.
Not at all.
Good morning to all of you, to our newfound friends in Russia, to our former friends in Canada, in Britain, and so many other places around the world.
All over Europe.
All right, 1-800-848-WABC. Alan, thanks for coming in today. Always good to have you, and we'll be talking about a Supreme Court justice nominee and your thoughts on that. And later on, we'll be speaking with someone that I've come to know and respect, and that's Joel Cohen, who's a well-known attorney at Strzok, talking about taking an oath and what that means. And interestingly, the biblical portion, or one of the portions read yesterday, talks about taking an oath. When you take an oath, you know, how serious should you be about taking that oath? And so it's good to discuss that. And then later on, we'll have Rabbi Mike Yurem, who's the director of Hillel, University of Pennsylvania, wrote a great book entitled The Next Generation of Judaism. And the fact that you have to write a book, The Next Generation of Judaism, in itself is scary because it suggests that things are changing, not always in a positive direction. But the rabbi has an interesting take as to what can be done to bring people, you know, into that tent, that there are different portals for entry in. So we'll have a good discussion with him. There's a quotation attributed to Theodore Roosevelt, which is the following. It's not the critic who counts, not the individual who points out how the other person stumbled. The credit belongs to the person who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. I think of that statement in recalling John Vigiano Sr. John Vigiano Sr. was buried yesterday. Father of two sons lost on 9/11. One was a firefighter and one was a member of NYPD. And John and Jan were so devoted to each other, but to the family and to the country. And I've often mentioned that when I asked John, do you believe in God in light of these two tragedies? He said, Rabbi, God didn't take my kids, terrorists did. And John would spend his remaining time going to Afghanistan, Iraq, Walter Reed Hospital, just to bring strength and support to those who were hurting so deeply. Here was someone with a hole in his heart, and yet he was able to reach out to others. So I look at John Vigiano Sr. He was one of those people Roosevelt, I think, would have agreed was the guy in the arena. We have a lot of people who criticize everybody else, but it's the guy who enters the arena willing to make a difference who deserves the credit.
My understanding, I didn't know John, but I've heard many, many stories about him and his sons, and he was an extraordinary person. Rabbi, I have to tell you, my family and I just came back from Ireland, and one of the stops we made, just along the road, there was just a sign about a garden dedicated to firefighters who lost their lives, the 343. And so we followed the signs, and there was a woman in Ireland who created a memorial and planted 343 trees to each of the firefighters who lost their lives. It is the most beautiful, peaceful memorial. There's a tree for each firefighter. Each one has their name. And it's clear that there are so many visitors that come to this site. Clearly, there are firefighters that come to visit the site because there are little mementos from each of the houses and things like that. It was one of the most moving places that I've ever been to. My family and I spent quite a bit of time there. We visited each tree and each memorial, said a prayer, took some photographs to show. I wanted to show Commissioner Cassano. Obviously, he knew all about it, and it was really something. I mean, the 9/11 is remembered worldwide.
Yeah, and this year coincides with the second day of Rosh Hashanah, so there'll be an opportunity to talk about it in different houses of worship. The others who've entered the arena, as Roosevelt described, would be the rescuers in Thailand. When you see the people who clearly put their lives in peril, who knew there was a good chance that even with the oxygen, that it might run out, as it did with one of these SEALs, the Thai SEALs. But they rescued all members of that soccer team, including the coach. How heroic was that? And also, look at the solidarity that was demonstrated by people who are different from one another, right? We live in a time where difference becomes highlighted and commonality is minimized. And here you found just the opposite. Who cared how different you were? We were on a common mission, and we need to be there for each other. So thankfully, there were those in Thailand who also entered the arena to save lives. We're surrounded by greatness, and unfortunately, we spend too much time belittling each other rather than recognizing the goodness in people. I'm convinced that there's far more goodness in the world than there is evil, but you know, there are some people who thrive on the other. There are some people who spend their days talking about all the negative aspects of life. You know, if there weren't hatred, they wouldn't be able to survive, and that's just a sad commentary on the mentality of some people. All right, we're going to pause for these messages and then come back with more of Religion on the Line.
Religion on the Line, 77 WABC. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick, 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
Alan, you should know the deacon is away with his family, with Gina and the family, attending a wedding of Kristen Horvath and Doug Prusoff. So congratulations to the couple and to the deacon for taking this well-deserved time. I met some people who knew him, Deacon Phil. And just it's always nice to hear nice things about someone else. And, of course, I've known Kevin for years. And you go somewhere and you say, I know Kevin. I went to school with Kevin. Great guy. And I said, gee, thank you, because you don't want to hear the other stuff. I was at a celebration recently, and somebody stood up. She happened to be a comedian. She was funny at times. And she said, she talked about observant people. And she said, one of the things about observant people is they're very good at observing others. There are people out there who claim to be observant, and I respect that. We all try to be observant in our own way. But there are some people who spend more time observing the religiosity of others than looking at their own behavior.
Yeah, I don't think they have any mirrors in their homes.
Yeah.
They never seem to see themselves. It's one thing to observe others, but through what lens?
Yeah, and I always wonder, why do you spend so much time looking, through that lens at other people and not enough time looking at yourself? What is it that's so important? That why are you a self-appointed? And by the way, I see this, on the internet. I see people who make all these comments always directed at someone else. And you say to yourself, if these individuals would spend some of that time looking within, introspection, they probably would be in a much better place. And by the way, they're always angry. I always find these people, they're always angry.
And so sure of themselves also.
Oh,
so there's never a question of their position.
No.
Never a look at the other side to see if there's any merit to that position at all. It's just full steam ahead. Not only am I right, but your position is, disloyal, dishonest.
Right.
I mean, there's never any give and take. There's never any recognition that there is some merit to the other side, but this offers a better way to reaching a goal that we all may share.
You know, it's interesting. We in Jewish tradition have tefillin phylacteries, the straps you wrap around the arm, you put them around the head. And if you open one of the compartments, the head compartment, you find there are different sections there. When you open the what goes around the arm, there's only one section there. The lesson being, when it comes to the head, when it comes to the mind, people think differently. When it comes to the hand, we hope we all work together. As we said before, you know, in Thailand and other crises around the world, that there is a united code. And I am just amazed at people, as you say, who have this certitude. They know exactly what the position is, and how dare you deviate from it. I remember when I was in law school, and you certainly have much more experience in reading opinions of Supreme Court justices. And I would read the majority opinion, and I'd read the minority opinion. I say, you know, reading both sides, I have a better understanding of the issue, and neither side is stupid. Neither side is pretty smart. Either side is pretty smart. You can, you know, lean more one direction, but you didn't dismiss a different opinion simply because it was different.
Well, and what I always find in court, and I've been doing this now for over 30 years, and I've learned from many, many people over my career, is, you know, never be disrespectful to your adversary. You can disagree passionately, and you can point out why you have the better position, and you can point out the flaws in their argument, but don't be disrespectful. Don't, you know, you can point out every inconsistency or where they've gone wrong, but when you make it personal, judges don't like it, judges don't respect it, it doesn't add weight to your position, and oftentimes it takes away from your position because I think it distracts the judge. Judges want to hear the best you have to offer, and they don't, I believe, they don't want to get distracted. And oftentimes I think sometimes clients don't understand that. They want to see you as, you know, the bull in the china shop, attacking your opponent as much as you're attacking their argument. And I don't think that's the way to go. I don't think that's most helpful to the client, and it doesn't give you the best opportunity to prevail on your argument.
Well, there's legitimate passion and misplaced passion.
Mm-hmm.
You have every right to be passionate about a position, and people, I think, admire that when you stand strong defending your position. But when you diminish somebody else's position, it says to me, you're not so strong in your position. The fact that you have to take time to attack someone else personally rather than stick to the position says you're somewhat weak, because if you were that strong, you wouldn't have to go after the person. I'm a great fan of General Perry Mason. Even Perry Mason and Hamilton Burgum, and Hamilton had a very poor record in the courtroom against Perry Mason. I don't think he ever won. Maybe he won one case. Was it one case he won? I don't remember, but I was told it was one case. But all the episodes
I saw.
That was
overturned on appeal, by the way.
But I just, you know, they would argue vehemently, and then at the end they would walk over to each other and you know, make some comments about the case. You have friends who are adversaries in the courtroom, but they're friends outside the courtroom.
Absolutely.
Right? And there's no problem with that. Now, you tell that to some of these yahoos out there, and they can't understand that. Because how can you befriend someone who dares take, you know, a different position? I was looking at the Roe v. Wade decision years ago, and I'm looking at Jewish tradition. And, you know, in Jewish law, abortion is permissible under circumstances, you know, threat to the mother's life. And you can, some interpret that as a psychological threat to the mother's life. And during the initial 40 days, there's much more latitude. And we differentiate between potential life and actual life. Now, I know that Kevin and I and Catholics and Jews can argue vehemently about that. And that's fine. I have my tradition. They have their tradition. But there's no reason why two traditions can't coexist, even though they're antithetical to each other, but we can have that intellectual discussion. But some people, my God, you take a position that's contrary to theirs, and you are condemned as a heretic, you are condemned as an idiot. It's a sad commentary. And I tell you, there is an atmosphere today that is simply, it's poisonous. And part of the responsibility is with our leadership in this country. You set a tone like that, you make it acceptable in high places. Why isn't it acceptable in any other place?
Absolutely. So. And it's getting worse. You know, my daughter always asks me and has been asking me for years, Dad, is this the worst you've ever seen it? And for years I've been saying, sweetie, you don't understand. you know, if you look back, you know, 1968, you look back in history and you see periods of lynchings and you see, I mean, there have been so many difficult times in American history. But now, I really think we're at a time now where the vitriol and the inability to talk to each other is unprecedented. Yeah. I watched those hearings the other day involving the FBI agent, and it was one of the low points that I've ever seen in American politics.
Because of the personal attacks.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and again, it, there is what to discuss here. There's what to debate, but you would think that people who have all this education, and I always say, education can make you smart, but not necessarily good, nice, or moral. We had a lot of bright people in the history of the world who did some immoral things with all their degrees, but they didn't have decency. All right, when we come back, one of our good friends, Joel Cohen.
And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm sitting in for the deacon. I'm Alan Abramson. Our next guest is a good friend of mine, is Joel Cohen. Joel is one of the true deans of the criminal defense bar, someone I consider a lawyer's lawyer. He's an experienced criminal defense lawyer, white collar. He has practiced at Strook and Levan for over 30 years. Before he was at Strook, Joel spent 10 years as a prosecutor with the New York State Special Prosecutor's Office, and then he was an assistant attorney in charge with the U.S. Justice Department's Organized Crime and Racketeering Section. He concentrated on investigations and prosecution of organized crime figures, corruption cases. Joel is also a prolific writer. He writes columns on criminal law and ethics for the New York Law Journal, Huffington Post, The Hill, Law and Crime. He is also a teacher at Fordham Law School, where he teaches classes on how judges decide. And I've attended many of those classes, and he gets federal judges from all over the country to come to the class to lecture his students. They are truly wonderful classes. He's also the author of many books, including Blindfolds Off, How Judges Decide, Broken Scales, Reflections on Injustice, which are both nonfiction books. He also writes novels, Truth Be Veiled, about a Justin Steele murder case, and writes about biblical fiction. He wrote a book called Moses, a memoir, David and Bathsheba, Through Nathan's Eyes. Joel is just an extraordinary lawyer and writer, a good friend. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for.
Yeah, exactly.
Morning.
We've come to the end of the segment. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you, Joel.
Coming on the air.
Any way I can help.
And he's also a devotee of a synagogue. I know his rabbi, Adam Minsky. His Adam was past president of the New York Board of Rabbis, and outstanding rabbi. So, Joel, the fact that you come in, you know, and bring both worlds together to me is a great statement about your Jewishness, that you can be a proud Jew and a proud attorney, and there's no conflict.
So, Joel, I know you have a new book. Why don't you tell our audience what the topic of your new book is?
Well, it's not a new book. It's a new book in creation that I'm writing with my colleague and friend Dale Degensheim, whom you know, Alan. She's also a lawyer here at the Strook firm. And it's sort of interesting. The book is about oaths, the oaths that people take during the course of their lives, and the oaths that certain professional people give to the profession to which they belong, such as a rabbi or a priest has an oath, a doctor has an oath, lawyers have an oath, professional politicians have oaths, cults have oaths. In other words, these oaths are beyond the kind of oaths or vows that one might take for himself or herself as, say, a New Year's resolution or the like, or an oath to a friend during the course of their lifetime as to what they might do for them if the friend predeceases. Say, for example, a friend two friends agree that if the other one predeceases, that they'll take care of their children financially. Those are personal oaths that people take, or people take oaths in terms of their religion. But these are oaths that are more mandated by a particular social order, such as the profession that they're in. The way I got the idea from the book, I have a friend of mine, David Mitchell, whom you may have met, Alan, who's a very successful businessman, and he knows that I write. And the other, maybe 2 months ago, I called him up and said, I want to write a book. I sort of write a book every 2-3 years, as you sort of mentioned. And I said, it's a new book, and this is a guy who's sort of a genius of sorts, and he thinks for 2 seconds, and he says, write a book about oaths. That's something that people haven't done in the past, might be worthwhile. And like within 3 seconds, I accepted the idea that David presented to me.
That's great. Well, Joe, let me ask you something. As a lawyer, we take oaths. We take an oath to protect client confidences. Attorney-client privilege kicks in. So sometimes we find ourselves in a difficult position. So let me ask you this question. What if a client tells us that they've committed a murder? Now, obviously, that's protected by the attorney-client privilege, but we also know that there is someone on trial or someone who's recently been convicted of the very murder that our client has told us that he, in fact, committed. And we know, though, that another person is about to spend the rest of their life incarcerated for a murder that they did not commit. What is the lawyer supposed to do? They've taken an oath. They have the attorney-client privilege. What's the lawyer supposed to do?
It's extraordinary. When I teach a class, as you mentioned, at Fordham Law School, I've taught ethics in the past for 10 or 15 years. And the first thing I say to the class at the beginning of the first session is, whatever morality or ethics that you have learned from your rabbi or your minister or your priest, your imam, maybe you learn your ethics or personal ethics from Oprah. You've got to leave that at the door, because the ethical or moral obligations that a lawyer has may be totally counterintuitive to what you learn in the real world. So, for example, imagine hearing from a person, let alone a client, hear from a person that he committed the murder that somebody else is serving life, maybe even facing a possible death sentence for, that he didn't commit. And you're the one person, you're the gatekeeper who actually knows that. In the real world, it is inconceivable that you or the rabbi or I or any, you know, thinking person could maintain that confidence that you've received, notwithstanding that somebody else is suffering so horribly from that injustice. And you would probably, you'd urge the guy to come forward and tell the truth. But short of that, as a lawyer, you're obliged to keep that confidence. And the case that I'm, or there are two cases, but one of them that Dale and I are writing about is a lawyer in North Carolina who received that kind of information that his client was in fact guilty of something that somebody else was serving a life sentence for. And he actually waited until after his own client died. So now there's nothing for that guy to suffer in this life from having disclosed his murder. He's not going to be convicted of something. He's dead. He then wants to disclose that in a federal court, first in a state court, for the purpose of exonerating the person who is, in fact, innocent. And the judge in the case wanted to have him disbarred for making that disclosure even after his own client was dead.
The judge wanted him disbarred.
Wanted him disbarred. Ultimately, he didn't get disbarred. Fortunately, common sense prevailed. It wasn't his decision ultimately to let the guy off the hook. But this lawyer's name is Staples Hughes in North Carolina. I think he's retired now. He wanted to make the disclosure and suffered the possibility of disbarment by doing, quote, the right thing.
Wow. Joel, I'm listening to this, and it sounds to me outrageous that someone else is suffering, and you, because of privilege, cannot reveal the information and simply allow someone, to languish in a prison, waiting for a client to die before he reveals the information. It offends one's moral core.
Well, it does, Rabbi, but take a look at it. And we're going to be writing about a thing called the clergyman privilege. So Supposing a congregant of yours comes to you, Rabbi, in your capacity as a rabbi, and makes a disclosure, I can't live with myself anymore, I need to tell it to you, Rabbi, because you, in my world, you are the closest thing to God. I want to tell you that I committed a murder that somebody else is responsible for. But, Rabbi, I don't want you to disclose right. that. I need to tell it to you. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I think it's happened. Aren't there cases of this? Look, this is what makes life so complicated. It's very hard because, on the one hand, you know, we're taught from the Bible that you can't stand by idly and watch, you know, someone else's blood being shed. So there's no such thing in Jewish tradition as an innocent bystander. Right. You have a moral responsibility to intercede, to intervene. So I respect the privilege, but this is one where I would call Joel Cohen of Strook and say, help me on this one. But I would really be in pain if I couldn't reveal that and know that for the rest of my life, someone else was unfairly in prison because of it.
What the law is now is the disciplinary rules have now changed where a lawyer may disclose under circumstances where it may cause death or imminent bodily injury. Mm-hmm. But it's not so clear in the case of a guy who's serving a life sentence that he is suffering that. And under the disciplinary rules currently in place in most jurisdictions for lawyers, a lawyer could not disclose. You are correct. There are cases involving priests. Maybe 15 years ago in the Southern District of New York, where a priest had that kind of information. He asked the penitent, it wasn't really a penitent, a man who had come to him in sort of a heart-to-heart, you know, come-to-Jesus moment, tells the priest, I killed the guy. The priest encourages the confessant to disclose. The guy does disclose. The district attorney says, this is a lot of baloney. I'm not accepting that. The court says, it's too late. We're not accepting your confession. The priest then waited until the penitent was dead, made the disclosure, and Judge Chin, who is now a Second Circuit judge previously on the Southern District, God bless him, he said that priest should be allowed to testify, and he exonerated by a habeas corpus proceeding the wrongly convicted defendant.
But there is a case, I remember reading, I think I learned this in law school, something you said earlier is that if somebody comes to me and says, I'm miserably married, and I'm telling this confidentially, I'm going to kill my wife. I don't want a divorce, I'm not going to go through the financial strain here, I'm going to murder her. And you believe that to be an imminent threat. Don't you have a responsibility to come forward and reveal it?
Yeah, and I think that the law and all disciplinary rules in all professions would allow you to make that kind of a disclosure because it relates to a future crime rather than a crime that had been committed in the past by the defendant who's disclosing it either to his lawyer or his rabbi or his psychiatrist or whomever.
Joel, in a slightly different context, a few weeks ago you moderated a really great CLE course with Floyd Abrams, who's an extraordinarily prominent First Amendment lawyer, represents the New York Times, Judy Miller, who wrote for the New York Times and was involved in the Scooter Libby case, and Jennifer Rogers. And that dealt with a reporter's obligation to protect a source. And in fact, Judy Miller went to prison because she wouldn't disclose her source in a circumstance where, in fact, she never wrote a story. But because she wouldn't disclose her source to a special prosecutor, she went to jail. Can you talk to us a little bit about that sort of oath or obligation that a reporter has?
Yeah, so Judy Miller, for me, is really a hero of the First Amendment. And if you gentlemen can ever get her on your show, you probably should, because she really has an awful lot to say. She was a reporter for the New York Times. She was sort of an embedded reporter in the Iraq War with the United States military. And what Judy did is during the course of there was ultimately sort of a scandal where there was a disclosure of the identity of Valerie Plame, who was a CIA operative or an agent of sorts. Her husband had been commissioned in the Bush administration to go to Niger to find out whether, in fact, uranium was there that was being purchased by Saddam Hussein to make weapons of mass destruction. He wrote an article in the New York Times saying that he found no what was called yellow cake, the uranium that was used for the purchase. And ostensibly, in retaliation for him saying something opposite the Bush administration's policy regarding Iraq, there was a leak of her identity, his wife's identity, as a CIA operative, which basically could result in her death so easily because her life is on the line if enemies of the United States find out that she's in the CIA. Well, Judy Miller got information from Scooter Libby, who was the chief of staff to the vice president of the United States, Dick Cheney, and he apparently disclosed to her, and apparently there were disclosures to a lot of people, that Valerie Plame was a CIA operative. Judy Miller did not write about it. However, the special prosecutor's name was Pat Fitzgerald, got onto the fact that Scooter Libby had made the disclosure to her, and they wanted her to testify. Judy felt she had an obligation of confidentiality to her source, Scooter Libby. She refused to disclose that information. She was subpoenaed to a grand jury. A district court held that she was in contempt and had to make the disclosure. She refused to make the disclosure. She went to jail for, notwithstanding the fact that Scooter Libby actually authorized her to make the disclosure that he was the source, she felt, and the New York Times felt, that basically he was required to do that by President Bush, who had basically told his entire staff, you have to cooperate with this investigation. She felt it wasn't really a willing disclosure that was being made by Scooter Libby to authorize her to disclose. And so she went to jail. She spent, I think, 2 or 3 months in jail. Interestingly, Scooter Libby, who was convicted, his sentence was commuted by President Bush, and he was later actually pardoned maybe a month or two ago by President Trump. But she took her responsibility of confidentiality so seriously that she was willing to go to jail for it. And that's why I call her a hero.
All right. We have to wrap it up. I want to have you back, Joel. You and Alan, you know, are highly regarded attorneys. I want to talk about the press, the role of the press, and getting a story right. And what about when they get a story wrong? You know, what recourse do you have?
Have you ever had that experience, Joel?
Not Joel. Yeah. No. We talk about the responsibility of clergy and lawyers, but what about the responsibility of the media to get a story right? I think this is a great opportunity to have that discussion in the future. So,
we'd be delighted to do so, Rabbi.
All right. Joel, thanks. So, and Joel, you know, I went to YU, Yeshiva University, and there we were taught synthesis. You can, you know, go to religious classes and secular classes, and you can represent both worlds without conflict. And you do it well. You know, you're a proud Jew, you're a proud attorney, and just a great role model. And Alan raves about you. And to be in the presence of you and Alan, really, for me, is a great honor.
By the way, it's mutual with Alan. He knows it, and a lot of people who I have referred to him know it. He is my go-to guy, and is an extraordinary lawyer in his own right.
Okay, so
thank
now,
you, Joel.
Now you can bill him more, Alan, now that he said that publicly. All right, thanks, Joel Cohen.
Thank you.
Stricken Levan. Let's pause for these messages.
Religion on the Line will continue right after this on WABC New York. 77 WABC.
35 years ago, things were different in the world. But Religion on the Line was here, helping make sense of it all. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick. 77 WABC.
Breaking the... Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for the deacon, I'm Alan Abramson.
All right, and you're doing a great job, and the deacon is away taking some well-deserved rest, and at the same time enjoying the wedding between Kristen Horvath and Doug Prusoff. So congratulations to them and to the deacon, to Gina, to the whole family. You know, I'll say when the deacon's not here. It really is great working with him. When he's here, I'll never tell him that. But it's a it's really it's an honor to come in on a regular basis. And by the way, speaking of an honor to come in, thank you, Izzy Richardson. Thank you, Bruce Clayton, for all that you do to make the program heard all these weeks and years. I'm going on my 36th year with Religion on the Line.
So. And for 38-year-old,
that's not bad.
Impressive.
I was a child prodigy.
That's pretty impressive.
And you know what I'm looking forward to? In a few weeks, I'm going to Israel, and I'm taking Mariano Rivera once again to the promised land. And as I always tell him, Mo, you need a Red Sox guy to show you the promised land. You couldn't do it without someone from Boston. So that's a nice thing. Al, we're going to take a break in just a minute, but the press, obviously, you know, you believe strongly in a free press, but when they get it wrong, it's got to be so damn frustrating. You have a client and they write things that you know are not so, and they admit to you, you've told me, they've admitted to you that the story is wrong, but they're not going to do anything about it.
It happens. Look, I have nothing but respect for the press. I'm a newspaper junkie. I have many, many friends who are reporters, and they try to get it right. But I have to tell you, I'm involved in one case. I don't want to mention the person's name on the air. But I have to tell you, I've seen it time and time again where they have absolute proof, but it is inconsistent with the narrative they have been running, and they refuse to write what they know to be true.
And they buy ink, as you say, by the barrel.
It's hard. Yeah. You don't pick fights with people that buy ink by the barrel.
Right.
That's the same.
All right, let's take a pause and come back.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion on the Line. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
All right. These are the 9 days on Jewish calendar when there's a moratorium on celebrations, on happy occasions, with some exception, for example, the birth of a child. But it's a period where it's a good time for a reflection. What transpired years ago, destruction of the temples, and what we have done since that destruction, how far we've come and how we were able to rebuild after tragedy. It's a great story. We'll talk more about Tisha B'Av, the culmination of the sad period, next week. So now let's go to a topic which some would say is sad, and I think our guest has a different take on it. Talking with Rabbi Mike Yoram, director of Hillel at University of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I recommend to everyone, as a matter of fact, I got a call from a friend, Rabbi Charles Klein. He said, have you read Rabbi Yoram's book, Next Generation of Judaism? I said, I have. And he said, you must read it. And I did. And then I had to speak at Hillcrest Jewish Center, and I recommended it to everyone there. So if your sales have skyrocketed, I take some of the credit. But it is a must read for all of us who struggle with this question: can we get millennials to connect with community, with Jewish community in this case? And by the way, in talking with the deacon, you know, his faith and other faiths struggle with the same question. Where are we vis-a-vis millennials? And I said earlier, before you came on, Rabbi, that what I learned from you and from others is we have to create as many portals as possible for entry. There isn't a one door where everybody's going to enter.
Correct. It's an interesting thing that's taking place right now, which is many people in the organized Jewish world and the organized religious world have this deep sense that things are shrinking because people aren't joining or showing up, that it represents a decline in the religion itself. And what actually I think the research shows is that feelings, particularly about Judaism, in the Pew study of 2013, 94% of American Jews feel positively or very positively about Judaism, which is double what it was in the 1980s. And that's in contrast to huge declining numbers of affiliation and joining and showing up. And I think what that means is it's not that religion is in decline, but it's trust and excitement about institutions. And as you made the connection, I think this is a crossover to kind of any legacy organization in a community, includes museums, umbrella charities, and churches. I think it's playing out in all these things. And the analogy that I often use is, imagine if we were a family business and we had bricks and mortar stores in a few major cities across the country, and that's what it meant to sell our product, was to get people to come into our stores and to buy a very high quality, very important product. But as the world began to change and Amazon comes online and there's international trade, we're still totally focused that it's only a success if people come into our stores and use our product. And I think when you sit down with the boards and the professional and volunteer lay leaders of most religious organizations, what they're worried about is who shows up, how many people come, how many people are joining. And the reality is the product that we're selling is not attendance or affiliation. It is the depth of the religious values and rituals and the things that people can use to make their lives better. So it's almost as if, to go back to the bricks and mortar store, that even though Amazon is there and could help us sell to millions more people, we're still stuck on the idea of how do we get them into our store.
But Rabbi, if you look at religious requirements, you need to have a quorum. You need to have people present. You know, you need for services, you know, you want community together. So if it's not brick and mortar and you have those requirements, you need people working as a team, people coming, you know, as a congregation. What do you do? What are the alternatives to that?
Yes, I think this is something that's not in the book, but I think it's helpful in kind of making the point, which is in the Jewish calendar, we have both holidays like Yom Kippur and holidays like Passover. And in Yom Kippur, everyone comes together into one large macro community. The service is led by professionals and the official leaders of the community. And there's a great sense of being together in a very large macro sense of community. But on the other side, you also have Passover Seders that exist in people's homes. And what's really interesting is the reason you show up at a high holiday service is because you have a membership or a ticket or you have some relationship with the institution. But the reason you show up at a Passover Seder is because you have a relationship. Someone invites you. Every Seder is different one from the other. And yet, even though everyone's in their own little micro community, people still feel like they're part of something much larger than just this small group of people gathering. So I think the organized Jewish community is a little bit stuck in the high holiday paradigm, and that all of the programming we do, whether it's religious or cultural or educational, tends to function on this high holiday paradigm. And what I'm actually arguing is that we keep that going, but we regain our ability to do this Passover paradigm. And the key here is that it's about unlocking the power of social networks to begin to activate and do Jewish things for themselves.
Rabbi, let me ask you something. I very rarely qualify my statements with, this may sound silly, but I feel like I have to do it here. But I have a young daughter. And I just,
that's not silly.
No, that's not silly. She's wonderful. And you know, she has deep cultural roots. She's a committed Jew. But I'm just wondering, you know, young people today, they often don't get together as often as I did with my friends. And, you know, if I wanted to talk to somebody, I had to go see them. You know, sometimes you do it on the phone, but that wasn't satisfying. But today, I mean, I see them in groups. They're doing FaceTime, and that's a real way of them socializing. And, you know, when I see them doing it, they're laughing. They're you know, participating in activities together. I mean, you know, Friday night services, Shabbos service, whatever it is that they want to do as a group of young Jews, they can do, you know, in a very sort of intimate way, you know, on a phone.
Facebook Live.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
And, you know, it's not, you know, coming to the shul. Coming to the shul is difficult for young people sometimes. Right. Are we missing an opportunity by, you know, not recognizing that this isn't, you know, the traditional ways that Jews gathered? There may be new ways for young Jews to gather.
Correct. No, I think you said it really well. I think that I believe that there will always be a significant core of people, again, whether it's Judaism or another religion or just a community organization, who are interested in and committed to the operating system where you show up in larger communities. But if, let's say in American Judaism, that about 15% of American Jews thrive in Jewish organizations, and the other 85% of American Jews either don't affiliate at all or affiliate in a kind of begrudging way because they need something. You know, it's time for their son or daughter's bar bat mitzvah, so they have to join a synagogue in order to get, you know, those services, so to speak. I think that we just need another answer for them. Even if it's not our ideal answer, there has to be another way. And I think the other big shift that I'm trying to advocate in this book is that almost everything we do in the organized Jewish community is what I call a receiving model, which is if we can figure out something really great to do together, we hope they'll show up, and then we try to improve the experience that people have once they show up. And what is kind of disruptive about the model that I'm pushing in the book is that I think there also has to be a seeking model where we actually go out and bring Jewish life to people wherever they live, work, and play. And that, just like you said, if we have a model of macro community where people show up in large groups, that there also needs to be a model where it's small and intimate and incredibly customizable. And there's some risk there. But what we've seen on campus where we're running this live experiment is that essentially by taking the institution out of it and allowing a group of Jews who knows each other, who maybe socializes together or works together, to all of a sudden begin engaging in Jewish activity together, that they're able to create something that's meaningful and that is on their own terms. And I'm not talking about fluff here. Right? These are things that are distinctively and meaningfully Jewish, like reading Jewish books, having Shabbat meals together, getting together with a rabbi to discuss some important idea. It just doesn't require them to show up in someone else's space.
So there was an article that appeared in one of the papers in New York. I think it said, liberal religion is destroying Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you saw the article, but it talked about the concept that we often referred to as tikkun olam, repair the world. And it's come to mean for many, let's get involved in everybody else's tzoris, everybody else's problems, but let's not get too involved in our own. You know, let somebody else worry about our own, but we get involved in everybody else. So you see Jewish kids in causes that are not don't directly impact on the welfare of the Jewish community. You know, they'll show up, they'll go to rallies for others, but not for their own.
Right.
How do you address that?
I think that one of the mistakes that we've made over time is that we've been focused, and we're really good at this, on a kind of crisis narrative, which is that the Jewish people is always shrinking, that there's always a risk of assimilation or anti-Semitism. And one of the byproducts of being stuck in a crisis narrative is that there's a subtext to everything we do, that the purpose of being Jewish or doing Jewish is to keep us alive, to ensure Jewish continuity. And I think one of the way that we reach the folks that you're talking about who maybe have replaced things that are distinctively Jewish with kind of very universal social justice causes is to flip the whole framing of this and a move from a crisis narrative to something that begins by building on assets. Mm-hmm. And I think the way this looks very simply is instead of thinking about Judaism just as a tradition, start to speak about it as a technology. And the difference between those is that a tradition is something you fit yourself into in order to sustain it. And a technology is something you use to make your life better, to figure out what kind of world you want to live in and to build that world. And so I think for people whose primary impulse is universal and tikkun olam focused, we haven't really done a great job of offering them an understanding of Shabbat or Jewish tech study as a technology that helps them be a better version of who they want to be, as opposed to seeing that as a competition with their other universal values.
Rabbi, we got to cut it here, but you're just a fascinating individual. We got to have you back and got to have you appear before some of the audiences in New York. Rabbi Mike Yoram, The Next Generation of Judaism, read it.
Thank you.
I think it'll open your eyes to some great possibilities in the Jewish world. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're listening to Religion on the Line on 77 WABC. 77 WABC.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick, 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
And Deacon, have a great, great weekend, enjoying yourself, you and Gina, and attending the wedding of Kristen Horvath and Doug Prusoff. Celebration for all. Let me say thank you to the Episcopalians, who at their conference voted down BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, unlike the Presbyterians who voted for it. But, you know, you look at what's going on in the world. We had Mike Yerim on. We're talking about diminution, fewer coming. You would think that religious groups would spend more time, again, looking within than looking at everybody else. And if you're going to look at everybody else, look at China, look at Iran, look at all, the transgressions being committed by so many people and nations in the world. But somehow Israel always rises to the top, always gets the prioritized attention of some of these groups. So the Episcopalians did the right thing, and they said, look, we'll work for peace, but BDS is not a strategy for peace. It's strictly singling out Israel, treating it unfairly when you ignore all of the others. Great story came out. A young girl needed emergency medical treatment. Malcolm Honlein, the President's Conference, told the story on John Batchelor. And a young girl needed this treatment, and Israeli soldiers risked their lives to bring her from the Syrian border into Israel at a hospital. She survived. She's doing well. Of course, there were no funds. The Israelis, paid for the whole thing. I don't know if she's going to be able to go back to Syria, but that didn't get attention in the newspapers.
Well, if she does go back to Syria, she can't tell anybody where she was treated.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, you wonder sometimes why certain stories don't make it and other stories do make it. I know so much of what's wrong in the world, it's very easy to find, but how about some of the things that are right in the world? And when someone does something noble, look, the Thai rescue, because it was so dramatic, got a lot of attention, and rightfully so. But how about when you save lives in other places? Shouldn't you get some, attention for that as well? So, it's frustrating. But thankfully, it was told, and we need to tell and retell it. And John Vigiano, Sr., I know God will welcome you with open arms and say thank you. You'll be reunited with your two sons, Joseph and John, in heaven. You did so much here on earth. You're entitled to reward in heaven. We really admire you for all you did. Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
77 WABC.